Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Today we are continuing to get to know our congressional delegation, who they are, why they serve, and next up, Jim McGovern. We recently visited the former chair of the House Rules Committee at his district office in Worcester. And he started by showing us some of the many pictures and artifacts that he's collected over more than 40 years in policy and politics. And for the record, Jim is no relation to George McGovern.
You're going to see a lot of George McGovern in this office. So I interned, I had a paid internship working for Senator McGovern when I was in college. I loved every minute of it. He's my hero, my mentor on so many issues. I worked in his office for 3 years. We became best of friends. When he ran for president briefly in 1984, I managed his Massachusetts campaign and nominated him for president at the 1984 Democratic Convention in San Francisco. But this is a poster from the 1984 campaign. This one is too. This is was his poster when he was running for re-election to the Senate in 1980. Unfortunately, he didn't win. But when I think of like giants in politics, Senator McGovern stands out. And if I could be one-tenth as effective and as good as he was in his job in the House and the Senate, then I would have accomplished a lot. This is a poster from Selma, Alabama. John Lewis, Congressman John Lewis, was a dear friend of mine, and I went on three different pilgrimages with him to Selma, Alabama, where we marched over the Edmund Pettus Bridge. As you may recall, in the struggle for voting rights, he was almost killed on that bridge by Alabama state troopers. I look at that and I think of him all the time. This is a picture of my dad who passed away right before COVID. This is when I became the chairman of the Rules Committee. And this article talks about the fact that before I got sworn in, a reporter was asking me about the gavel that the chairman of the Rules Committee has, because there's histories behind gavels. And there was a history behind the gavel for the chair of the Appropriations Committee in Ways and Means. And so I had asked the team, I said, where's my gavel? And they said, well, we don't know where it is. Maybe your predecessor took it with him. But I didn't have a gavel, so my dad, Walter McGovern, brought a gavel and gave it to me. But the interesting thing about that gavel, and I didn't realize it at the time because it had a little plate on it, I just assumed it said Jim McGovern, Chairman of the Rules Committee. Well, my father owned a package store here in Worcester,
right.
And he was the president of the Worcester County Package Store Association. And during the first hearing, I'm looking at the little plate and it says Walter F. McGovern, president of Worcester County Package Store Association. So that was the gavel that I used as chairman of the Rules Committee. I think if you unscrew it, it might be a flask. I don't know. But anyway.
Did that stick? I mean, the whole time?
Yeah, I still, you know, and if I become chairman again, I'm going to continue.
You're going to keep using it?
I'm going to keep it. It has sentimental value.
Pause for a minute. Look across this whole thing. Of all of these, which one speaks most to you as a moral man or a spiritual man?
You're asking me weighty questions.
That's the only kind I'm going to ask.
I mean, they all mean something to me for different reasons. But in terms of what has influenced my politics and my life the most, really are George McGovern, and then you'll see in the other room, Joe Moakley, who I worked for many years. Those were my two teachers, people who inspired me in different ways, and they were different people. But the one thing they both had in common were they were among the most decent people I have ever met in my life. And obviously, my dad's picture has sentimental value to me. I look at it all the time, and I miss him a lot.
You lost him in 18.
When did COVID begin?
Late 19 or 20.
Yeah, November before.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, he, I think of him all the time as well. He was a wonderful, decent, kind human being who I think was happy I got elected to Congress so he could help some of the customers that came into his store who had who were facing difficult challenges. You know, I get a call, hey, Joe's here and he can't find affordable housing, or Mary's here and her son lost her passport, or, you know, Zach is here, he doesn't know where, you know, where to go to get help for his son's mental health challenge. I mean, you name it. It was like I got more of my casework from McGovern's package store. And my mother worked there for a while too, so I got all the stuff from her and him. It's still there. My brother-in-law is running it, but I surround myself with things that mean things to me. I mean, nothing in this, everything you see in this office means something to me.
You're not just displaying.
Right. And this was a story. This is a picture of me getting arrested in front of the Sudanese embassy, protesting the genocide that was ongoing in Sudan. John Lewis was arrested with me at that same protest, and it was an honor to share a cell with John Lewis, who had been arrested many times for many different things. But I was arrested 3 times in front of the Sudanese embassy as a member of Congress, and I was arrested in front of the South African embassy when I was protesting apartheid. This was before I got elected to Congress. I was working for Joe Moakley.
Was that the first time you were arrested in South Africa?
Yeah. I get the James Beard Award for my work on nutrition and hunger. And anyway, the actual award is in Washington, but these are some of the pictures that were in the program, which when I think of the James Beard Award, I think of great chefs that have, you know, have received the award. So I do a lot of cooking, but I'm hardly great. These are some of my Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton wall. When Hillary ran for president the first time, this was my daughter, Molly. She wanted to go up on the stage with me. And my wife was like, you know, she's never been before a huge crowd. And
she was she, 3, 4?
Yeah, she was 3 years old, 3.5, 4 years old at the time. For her, it was a big deal that she said back then a girl was running for president, and the kids at her young age were talking about it. And I was like, so she wanted to come up, and there were thousands of people. It was at Clark University. And when they all screamed, and I looked at her face, I'm like, oh God, don't cry. But she didn't. She knew what to do. This was like on the front pages of a whole bunch of newspapers all throughout the country of her waving to Hillary, giving her a welcome. My Moakley bumper sticker that I treasure very much. There's a picture of Joe Moakley and myself on the front page of a Salvador newspaper visiting a health clinic in El Salvador. Look, Joe Moakley was, I had a ball working for him. He was so much fun. He was so real, and he was so human and so caring. And I mean, he met with everybody, he talked to everybody. Nobody was invisible to him. Everybody was important. And I'd like to think that, you know, hopefully I'm following his lead in the way I try to do business in Congress.
Now, after a tour of the office, we sat down and talked about a watershed moment in his life of service when Massachusetts Congressman Joseph Moakley called on McGovern to investigate the 1989 murder of 6 Jesuit priests and 2 others in El Salvador.
Yeah, so we had worked on Salvadoran issues prior to that, mostly with regard to refugees who had come to Boston, and Moakley championed this effort to provide temporary protection for these refugees. He was the author of a provision called the Temporary Protected Status, which is still being used today to help.
TPS.
Yeah, right. TPS, that's still being used to protect migrants from countries that are in turmoil. Anyway, shortly after he had passed that statute, we got news that 6 priests, their housekeeper and daughter, were murdered at the University of Central America. 3 of the priests we knew because he had worked with on refugee issues up to that point.
How did you get word that they'd been killed?
I got a call like at about 4 o'clock in the morning from a friend of mine who worked for a human rights organization. She was a Salvadoran woman and she was crying. I didn't know what had happened. I kept on asking her, Sylvia, tell me what's the problem? She said, they killed them all. I said, what are you talking about? And she said, the Jesuits, they killed them all. And when she composed herself, she told me they're all dead. The 6 leading Jesuits at the University of Central America were murdered. And I waited an hour, because it was like 4 in the morning. I waited, I called Moakley, and he couldn't believe it. And the Speaker of the House at the time was Tom Foley. And at a Democratic caucus meeting, members were complaining that, you know, we need to do something, that, you know, we were being told that everything in El Salvador was fine, And yet here is this terrible tragedy. What are you going to do about it? We need to do something. And so it was decided that a special task force would be created, and they asked Joe Moakley to chair it. And so Moakley then called me up and said, look, I just got appointed to this. I need you to be my point person on it.
But this was personal for you, too. You knew three of the priests.
It was. And I, shortly after he was appointed, I went down to El Salvador with another aide who worked for Gary Studs at the time, Bill Woodward. And we went to the site where the priests were killed. I remember the bloodstains were still on the grass. And, you know, we went down to basically prepare a trip for Moakley and other members of Congress to come in the following weeks. And, you know, we were trying to just get some information about what happened. Look, I don't speak Spanish. I have no background in investigations. Of all the people to kind of be the point person, I'm the least likely. In retrospect, he should have hired somebody who actually had some experience. But he trusted me, and so I did it. And we worked with a Salvadoran, a guy named Leonel Gomez, who got political asylum in the United States because he was the target of death squads. But he went back down to help us investigate these murders. And
so he was in the U.S. because he'd already been threatened,
and he came back to El Salvador. Came back to El Salvador. In any event, that began 2 years of investigations and frequent trips to El Salvador, some in which Moakley was at, and it was life-changing for me. I was born and raised a Catholic. At some point in my life, maybe around college, I kind of drifted away from the church because I wasn't feeling it. Working in El Salvador to Jesuits in the 1980s, even before they were killed, but especially in the aftermath of it, it reaffirmed my faith. I mean, I actually felt a tie to Catholicism that I didn't feel before. And part of it was because these Jesuits, I mean, when it says feed the hungry, they took it literally. We're going to go feed the hungry and comfort the afflicted. They went and they stood with people. They helped people who were sick. When people were disappeared, they'd show up at jails. I mean, they lived their faith. It was real. It wasn't just going through the motions.
And they had been warned, hadn't they?
They had been warned. In fact, I remember one time, maybe about a year before they were killed, I went and visited the rector, Father Ignacio Ellacuría, and we were supposed to meet at a coffee shop. And he had called me at my hotel and said, out of an abundance of caution, because I'm worried about your safety, he says, we've gotten a number of death threats against him, the director. Why don't we meet at the campus? So it's just safer for everybody. But I never thought anybody would go after these priests. I mean,
I want to go back now. Mm-hmm. I want to go back to your parents. And you're growing up in Worcester and the package store.
Right.
You lost your dad shortly before COVID. Yeah. Your mom worked in the package store for a little while.
She also was a dance teacher for many years, too.
What kind of dance?
Everything.
All of it.
Everything, you know.
Had she been a dancer?
She trained to be a dancer when she was in high school and auditioned for the Radio City Rockettes, but ended up marrying my dad at 18 and got pregnant with me that year as well. So that ended her Rockettes career.
How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I wish she would have had a couple of years to do high kicks with the Rockettes. I think that would have been a nice thing for her to do. But I think she's happy with the life she ended up with.
So that business is still in the extended family.
Correct.
Why is it not your business? Did you ever think you'd go into the family business?
I didn't. I worked there when I was younger. But my interests were someplace else. It wasn't that I didn't want to do it. And my father wasn't trying to get me to do it. And I learned some important lessons at the package store. Waiting on customers and stocking shelves and, you know.
Like what?
Well, I mean, you know, it's hard work. And sometimes, you know, the person behind the register is more than just a person behind the register. Sometimes you have to be I think sometimes you do therapy. I mean, we had intense conversations with people of all backgrounds on a whole bunch of stuff. But it was a neighborhood place, too. You know, it's like that TV series Cheers, you know, where it was kind of a neighborhood bar. Well, it's kind of a neighborhood package store. And so everybody kind of knows everybody. And so sometimes people come in to get a six pack or a case of something, and then they'd bump into somebody else there, and then they'd go into the corner and talk for a half an hour. I mean, it was a place of a lot of socialization going on, right? A lot of back and forth. And I said, my father, incredibly decent human being, you know, everybody mattered. And that's why he lived his life. And he worked like crazy to get me elected to Congress. I mean,
He wanted that for you.
He wanted that.
When did you first know you wanted that for you?
I ran first in 1994, and I was out to dinner with some friends, and I was complaining about the congressperson who represented this area, who was much more conservative than I was, and he's a nice guy, but just his politics were much more to the right, and a friend of mine just said to me, well, why don't you run?
You really hadn't thought about it before
I had,
then?
No, because I just never thought of myself as the candidate. So I was married, and my wife, Lisa, we had a conversation, and she said, well, if you want to do it, do it. So I ran, and things I thought would be easy were hard, and things I thought would be hard were easy.
What I thought would be hard
was I wouldn't know the answer to questions. You run for office, nobody wants to, you know, look like you don't know what you're talking about. I mean, the fear of looking ridiculous, right? What I found was that even if I didn't know the answer to something, I could say to the person asking the question, you know what, I don't know, but let me learn about it and I'll get back to you. And people accepted that. The hardest part for me was the retail politics. I was an awkward candidate. It just didn't come naturally to me to walk into a room and say, hey, everybody, I'm here, I'm great, vote for me, I'm wonderful, right? It just was awkward. And Moakley would often comment. He said, let me give you a few jokes to open up with. So you're too serious. You got to smile a little bit more. And he used to complain to me that, I used to say, they're not funny. He goes, no, it's in the delivery. And your delivery, you got to work in the delivery.
He says, no, you're not funny.
Yeah. I was like, oh, you know, so whatever. Anyway, I had a crowded field of primary candidates, and I came in second in that race. And I remember I got two calls. George McGovern called me and said, you know, you ran a good race, be proud of it. And, you know, you might want to think about it again in 2 years if the Democrat doesn't win in the general election. And then Joe Moakley called him and said, what happened? I told everybody you were going to win. You didn't win. What am I going to tell people? I said, well, it just didn't work out. And then 2 years later, I did it again with Moakley's blessing. And he came in and campaigned for me hard. And George McGovern came in and campaigned for me hard. And nobody believed I could win. They did. And then again, on election night 1996, when the polls closed, people said I lost. I remember someone said, Joe Moakley's trying to get a hold of you. I'm like, I can't talk to him right now. And then I was winning, and he called again, and I said, yeah. He says, hey, congratulations. I'm glad I could help you win. I said, well, great. He says, you made all the difference. But in many respects, he did, and George McGovern did, too. They're my teachers. They were my examples. And different personalities, but both very decent human beings. You know, and the whole during the El Salvador stuff, somebody asked Joe Moakley, you know, why are you so passionate about getting justice for these Jesuit priests? And he said, you know what? He says, because I hate bullies. And he talked about the story when he was a kid that his dad was driving down the street in South Boston and stopped the car. And he said, Joe, what do you see over there? He said, I see two kids fighting with each other. He said, yeah. He said, well, look closer. What do you see? He said, I see a big kid punching the crap out of a little kid. He says, that's right. He says, you think that's fair? He goes, Joe Moakley said, no, I don't. He says, get out of the car and even the fight. And he got out and helped the little kid beat off the big kid. But he said, ever since then, I just have this dislike and this intolerance for bullies, whether it's in El Salvador or whether it's in the United States when vulnerable people are getting picked on or being ignored. You know, I want to even the score.
Is that you too?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I mean. I feel that way. I mean, the fights I feel most passionate about in terms of getting involved with are fights where, you know, you help even the score. You help, you know, people who, you know, are pushed aside or viewed as being invisible, and, you know, you give them a fighting chance.
I really, really want to understand where that comes from for you.
Well, my mother and father, you know, raised my sisters and I to understand that we were lucky. And
yeah, but a lot of people's parents do that.
Yeah, well, but mine, you know, mine actually did more than just say that. I mean, they brought food to people who needed help. You know, they helped neighbors out who were struggling to pay their mortgages. I don't know how many times my father gave away stuff at the package store to people. I mean, I grew up with that. I mean, that was, to me, the way people behaved. You know, when I got elected to Congress, they both, McGovern and Moakley, sat with me, and I asked them both while I was waiting to get sworn in, give me the best advice to be a good member of Congress. And George McGovern's advice was, if you want to be a good member of Congress, you have to get over the fear of losing an election, because if all you care about is the next election, you'll just be a reflection of the latest public opinion poll. Joe Moakley's advice was, if you want to be a good member of Congress, get to know everybody on a first-name basis, get to know if they have spouses, dogs, cats, canaries, kids, whatever. but build relationships, because politics is about relationships, and you may need somebody to join you on a cause that they don't feel very strongly about, but they might not because of your party affiliation. So you just, if they might help you out if they like you. And I thought both of those things were very, very good advice. You know, I have seen a lot in my life. I mean, I've seen hungry children in Worcester, all throughout my district. It breaks your heart. I mean, we live in the richest country in the history of the world, and we have 35 million Americans who don't know where the next meal is going to come from. You know, I've been to El Salvador. I've had friends, and not just the Jesuits, but I've had friends disappeared and murdered. You know, I've seen incredible poverty and incredible cruelty. Look, I've been given this great gift to be in Congress. You know, I mean, I'm not everybody's cup of tea. I get it. I get people who love me and people who give me the middle finger, right? Whatever. But I've been given this gift. I don't want to squander it. And, you know, I don't want to waste time. And I want to get as much done as I can. I want to help as many people as I can, because that's why I ran. I ran not because I wanted to run for president or Senate or anything like that. I ran because I wanted to help people in my community and help people all around the world who needed a voice.
You have been in policy or politics for more than 40 years. Mm-hmm. Is your heart broken more or less?
It depends what day it is. I mean, there are moments when I'm stunned by the insensitivity and the cruelty of some of the people who I serve with, because I think they should know better, but they still do things that I think are cruel and that hurt people. But I'm also inspired by the fact that the movement toward justice continues, and we have victories every once in a while. And the Trump years were incredibly depressing for me, but I'm really proud of the work that we've done post-Trump. A lot of good stuff, a lot of stuff that people don't appreciate or even know about, but a lot of good stuff to help people. And I want to build on that. We got the second ever White House conference on hunger, nutrition, and health ever, right?
And the first one was like 40 years ago.
Right. 1969, the year we landed somebody on the moon.
More than 50 years
ago. Right, yeah. And this conference was spectacular. And what was really good about it was one of the things we insisted on is that the people who speak and participate in this conference can't just be the politicians and the heads of groups and the heads of this or the heads of that, but we want people with lived experience to come and tell us their stories and what works, what doesn't. We want to give credibility and we want to elevate their voices. So, I mean, I go back and forth. I mean, there are days that, you know, it's like, oh my God, like, I can't believe this. But there are other days that are inspiring and uplifting. And, you know, I still love this job. If I didn't, I'd be done. I mean, I still might be done anyway. The voters may not reelect me. But the point of the matter is that, I mean, I still enjoy getting up in the morning and going to work. And I have a great staff, and my wife is unbelievably supportive, and she shares many of these passions that I do. My two kids are wonderful, I like the work that I'm doing. It's meaningful. It's making a difference, and it's very satisfying to me.
Massachusetts Congressman Jim McGovern there talking with us at his district office in Worcester last month.